So, hello, everybody. I want to say a special hello to the La Mer group in Singapore, who, many of them came to the Abbey for the resounding, and some of them stayed on afterwards. And, they left last Friday before the teaching, so they never had the opportunity to see one of the teachings in the Posada room. But that's where we are right now. And we're thinking of all of you in Singapore. And since you missed the teaching in the Posada room last time, you have to come to the Abbey again. Yeah, and then we'll have some more teachings in the Posada room. You can get a feeling of what it's like. It's, really quite a nice room. Yeah, and now lots of evening sun is coming in. Yeah. Okay. So with that, we will continue with following in the footsteps of the Buddha. We're on the chapter, The Four Establishments of Mindfulness, and we just began that. We didn't get too far. And so he's introducing the four establishments of mindfulness kind of as a group first, and then getting into their how you meditate on each of them individually. Okay, so we'll be covering that kind of general perspective this time. Okay. But first, we will start with visualizing the objects of refuge. And Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the space in front. And ourselves surrounded by all sentient beings. Let's generate our motivation. So in Buddhism, there's no idea of divine justice. Divine justice is an idea that pertains to theistic religions. But in Buddhism, nobody judges us. Nobody punishes us or rewards us. There's just the very simple system of cause and effect, which when it pertains to ethical deeds, we call it karma and its effects. So our actions of body, speech, and mind, and the effects that they have on us in this life and future lives. So this is just a very natural system of cause and effect, in the same way that gravity is a system of nature, all these kinds of the way things function biologically, physically, and so on. That's just according to their nature. And so similarly in Buddhism, according to the nature of the kinds of actions we do, what kind of mind motivated them, especially that, and how the actions were done, what particular actions were done, and so on, then we create the cause for our own experiences. So when we have happiness, it looks like it's coming from outside, but actually the principal cause of our happiness is our virtuous actions. When we have suffering or problems, again, it's the principal cause is not outside of us. It's our own non-virtuous actions. And so this gives us a lot of power to change our experience of the future, yeah, by doing actions now, we create the causes for our future. And we want to have a good rebirth, but more than that, we want to really become fully awakened Buddhas to be able to best benefit all the other sentient beings. And when we look at so many of the sentient beings in this world, it's not too difficult to have compassion when you think that they don't know about the functioning of cause and effect. Yeah. So sometimes the way they think of virtue and non-virtue differs because there's a God that gives punishments and rewards. Many of the basic ethical things are the same in all religions. But the idea of divine justice is quite different, and Buddhism doesn't have that. But when we see living beings who don't know about karma and its effects, and who aren't following the wise instructions for them from their own religions, and thus are creating so many non-virtuous actions that harm others and harm themselves, then we have to have compassion for the ignorance that lies beneath all this. But it's not just a thing of saying others are ignorant. We have the fundamental ignorance as well, because we don't understand either conventional reality properly, or maybe it's better to say conventional existence properly, or ultimate reality properly. So these are things that we want to learn and practice. And the teachings on the four establishments of mindfulness really set us going in that direction. So with that thought, we will share the Dharma this evening. So we actually stopped at the bottom of page 330, but I'm going to read the last paragraph again, because it kind of introduces the topic to us. Actually, the last two paragraphs. Okay. A definition of establishment of mindfulness is an exalted knower, in other words, a mind of someone who has entered a path included within either mindfulness or wisdom that meditates on the four bodies, feelings, minds, and phenomena. Through examining the specific and general characteristics of each of them. Although this definition places, sorry, my voice is weird tonight, I don't know why. Change the pitch. Although this definition places this practice as one accomplished by a person who has already entered a path of any of the three vehicles, it is also done by people who have not yet entered a path. Because how are you going to enter the path having established that if you don't practice it before? Okay, which is why we want to learn it. So this practice is powerful and beneficial for everybody. Yeah. So in the four establishments of mindfulness, the meaning of mindfulness is slightly different than in other contexts, okay? As before, here mindfulness functions to keep the mind on its chosen object, okay? That's in common with all forms of mindfulness. But in addition, it is combined with powerful wisdom that understands those four objects, the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Okay, so it isn't just holding the object firmly in the mind like we do when we're cultivating serenity. And it isn't secular mindfulness of just being aware of what's happening right now. It's something that has a factor of wisdom that brings understanding in our mind. Yeah, so that's quite important. Okay. Of the four objects, body refers to three kinds of body: the internal, external, and both internal and external bodies. Okay. The internal body consists of the five sense faculties, or sometimes it's translated five sense powers. So those are such as the eye, ear, and so on, faculties, yeah? These are subtle forms located in the coarse sense organ. So the eyeball, the ear, the nose, mouth, you know, the tongue, these are all the coarse organs. But the actual sense power, sense faculty that connects the external object to the consciousness and creates perception, yeah, that one is very, very subtle, yeah. So it's not just the external one. So they are considered internal because they are associated with our own mind in that they enable our sense consciousnesses to perceive external objects, okay. So as I mentioned last time, there's some thought that maybe the cones and rods in the back of the eye are the, you know, the subtle sense organ for the visual consciousness. I don't know, you know, but this is some thought that it has. Or what's it called in the inner ear, the hammer and the stirrup, something? You know, maybe that is for the auditory consciousness. You know, faculty. But again, I don't know for sure. We have to get the Buddhists and the scientists together. Yeah. Will they ever agree on one? Will even either of those two groups agree? Yeah. Okay. The external body refers to the environment and the things in it that are the five sense objects, visual sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and tactile objects. Okay, it can also refer to the sense faculties of others because they are external to us. The body that is both internal and external refers to the coarse physical sense organs, the eyeball, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and so on. Okay, the skin. So these organs are external compared to the sense faculties and internal because they are associated with feeling. Okay, practitioners meditate on these, forsaking covetousness and displeasure concerning the world. So in the sutra, you know, about the four establishments of mindfulness, this phrase comes up for everyone when you contemplate it, forsaking covetousness and displeasure concerning the world. In other words, when you contemplate the body, you know, feelings and so on, you're not going to do it in a way that generates attachment, you know, looking for to have some happiness or looking to get some kind of object or status, and you don't meditate on it, thinking about displeasure. This sound is too loud, you know, this, our usual complaints, the food is burnt, you know. So we're not meditating with those kind of judgments that come from the ignorance lying behind attachment to the eight worldly concerns. Okay, so forsaking covetousness is to abandon attachment and forsaking displeasure is to abandon mental unhappiness, which is the cause of anger. Okay, now, you might be meditating on the body, for example, and going over it. And when you're thinking about the insides of your body, you go, ugh, you know. Well, isn't that displeasure? Yeah. So how what do you mean meditate on the body without attachment or displeasure? Or you're meditating on the body and you realize, oh, my stomach is full. It feels so good. Yeah. Actually, those are talking about feelings. That's meditation on feelings. Yeah. When we meditate on the body, we want to see the body as foul in the sense that it's unclean and it's, it's kind of foul. Yeah. But we don't want to have an attitude of, we want to be able to see the body for what it is with a balanced mind, without getting attached to it and without having repulsion, you know, kind of this angry, you know, repulsion. Okay. So feelings refer to our feelings of pleasure, pain, and neutral feelings. Okay. A pleasant feeling or happiness is the experience of contentment. An unpleasant feeling or unhappiness is the experience of pain. A neutral feeling, so-called equanimity, is a feeling that is neither contentment nor pain. Okay, so, you know, what's neutral feeling? Are you paying attention to the calf on your left leg? Until I said that, were you aware of what was going on in the calf in your left leg? No. Probably because there's a neutral feeling. Okay? So it's not drawing attention to it. When the sound was sound like blasting, it was drawing my attention to it. Yeah, it was unpleasant. I had the feeling of displeasure with that. Okay. Somebody touches you when the cat comes and, you know, she's all soft and furry and she, you know, rubs against you. There's a pleasant feeling on your skin. Okay. But these can also be mental feelings. Yeah. When you hear news that you consider good news, you have a pleasant feeling. When you consider news that you consider bad news, you have an unpleasant feeling. And then so many of our things are just kind of neutral. But we would really rather all the neutral things be pleasant. We are addicts to pleasant feelings. Yeah. Okay. So we'll get into that more when we go into that specific establishment of mindfulness. Some feelings, such as mental happiness of thinking about an enjoyable situation, accompany a mental consciousness. Okay, so until now we were talking about physical feelings, yeah, but mental feelings, yeah. When you sit and ruminate about a fight you had with a kid on the playground when you were in fourth grade, that's mental feeling, okay? Yeah, that's coming up. But we can see that, you know, how what we think about creates a lot of feelings in our mind. Yeah, when we ruminate about something, there's unpleasant feeling, then we get in a bad mood. When we have some good news, then we're elated and we're in a good mood. Okay. So we have the mental feelings, yeah. And the feelings, our response to the feelings, yeah, whew, this is what makes us make choices. Yeah, when there's a pleasant feeling, I want more, I want better. When there's an unpleasant feeling, get it away. Okay, when there's a neutral feeling, I'm spaced out, I don't notice it. Okay. The Sutra on the Ten Grounds speaks of bodhisattvas meditating on inner, outer, and both inner and outer feelings. Inner feelings are those we ourselves experience. Outer feelings are those experienced by others. And inner and outer feelings are the pleasurable, painful, or neutral feelings experienced by the tactile consciousness in the coarse physical sense organs. Okay, so outer feelings, yeah, those experienced by others, inner feelings, those that we have ourselves, inner and outer is, you know, the feelings by the tactile consciousness, because that that sense organ is inner, but the things we're experiencing are very outer and, yeah. Okay. So the mind, so this is the third of the four establishments, objects of the four establishments. The mind refers to the six primary consciousnesses. Okay, primary consciousness is a consciousness that just perceives one type of object. The visual consciousness, yeah, has its own sense power in the eyeball, not the eyeball, and it perceives visible sights. Yeah, the ear sense consciousness or auditory sense consciousness, yeah, hears sounds. So, you know, there's six consciousnesses. Yeah, each one has a sense power, and each one has its own type of objects. Okay. So our ear consciousness can't see things. Yeah, they don't cross function like that. A Buddha's sense consciousnesses are omniscient. And can do perception like that. Okay, so the mind refers to the six primary consciousnesses. When describing the practice of the four establishments of mindfulness, the Sutra on the Ten Grounds instructs us to be mindful of inner, outer, and both inner and outer thoughts or mind. Outer thoughts? Outer minds, wait and listen. The inner mind is the mental consciousness. The outer mind is the sense consciousnesses. And the inner and outer mind is the mind that apprehends the sense organs, that the gross eyeball, the ear, and so on. Being mindful of these involves knowing if these minds are virtuous or non-virtuous, with or without attachment, accompanied by animosity or not. Okay, so we have the object, the feeling that it gets when there's perception, and that is experienced by a particular consciousness. Then the fourth one, phenomena, includes all other phenomena, both impermanent and permanent, that have not been included in bodies, feelings, and mind. These are mental objects. Okay. Some examples are mental factors other than feelings. So these are considered phenomena. For example, attachment, anger, faith, integrity, these are all mental factors that are not feelings. So they're included in the fourth one of phenomena. Okay. Phenomena also includes abstract composites, okay, like the person. Yeah. And unconditioned phenomena includes nirvana. Okay. Inner phenomena, you know, what we're striving for, inner phenomena are the two true paths. Outer phenomena are true cessations. And inner and outer phenomena are persons. Okay. So the reasons these four objects are selected as objects of mindfulness is to show us ordinary beings four conceptual errors that we have. Okay, so I find this quite, you know, this next section quite interesting personally, okay? So the four conceptual errors. First one, conceiving our body to be the residence or place where the self resides. So we think, I am here. Yeah, when you say, I'm here, there's something inside the body, isn't it? You know, you don't say, I'm here, and you're referring to something across the room or in the sky. You know, there's some feeling of a body. Yeah. So conceiving our body to be the residence or place where the self resides. I am here inside my body. This is a conceptual error. Yeah. Why is thinking I am here inside my body a conceptual error? Yeah. We're thinking that there is a real self that is physically inside the body. Yeah, that's how we feel, isn't it? Until we start looking for it, and then we can't find it. But when we aren't looking, boy, there's me inside of here. Yeah? Okay, then the second conceptual error, conceiving our feelings to be what the self enjoys and experiences. I feel happy. I feel miserable. I feel indifferent. Okay? So, conceiving our feelings to be what the self enjoys and experiences. Okay, what's the conceptual error? Again, there is a real self. Yeah, and there are real feelings. And I experience my feelings when my stomach hurts. You know, it's focused on the I, isn't it? Yeah. The third conceptual error, conceiving our mind to be a real self. I am what thinks and perceives. Oh, boy. Yeah. Who am I? What do I do? I am the one who thinks and perceives. Yeah. And I just happen to be located in here. Yeah. And I experience things that this body gives me and that I remember, that I create mentally. Then the fourth one, okay, conceiving phenomena, in particular mental factors, as what makes the self afflictive or worthwhile. Okay, so the mental factors, are they afflicting us or are they making us worthwhile? I have so many problems with anger and jealousy. Yeah, these are the phenomena that afflict us. Or, I am worthwhile because I am mindful, make effort, and have concentration and wisdom. Okay, so those mental factors are what make me worthwhile. Anger and jealousy are what make me non-virtuous. Okay? Again, the idea that there's a real I in all four of these. Yeah. We see destructive emotions and wrong views as something the person, the I, should purify, and constructive mental factors as something we should adopt. So the whole thing is centered on I. Yeah. And these four are the chief objects that, are our life experience, either by perceiving them or experiencing them, thinking about them. Yeah. Okay. So the way the self is conceived in each of these instances is erroneous. There is a notion of a solid personal identity. We see ourselves as standing alone, independent from everything else, and we view all other things, including our body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, as arranged around that self. Aren't they? There's a real me, and what is this real me chiefly concerned with? Yeah, body, feelings, mind, phenomena. Okay. In addition, our present way of conceiving and relating to our body, feelings, mind, and phenomena increases our misconception of self, because we think each of these four also is real and inherently existent. Okay? And since these are the foremost things that we think about, and they're inherently existent, and when we say I, we're referring to one of those, then, yeah, it is re-solidifying the idea of ourselves. Okay. Another reason these four are selected as objects of mindfulness is to help us understand how destructive and constructive actions come about so that we can abandon the former and practice the latter. Okay, so here are four points regarding that. We want to understand how constructive and destructive actions come about, how they arise, and for the purpose of abandoning the non-virtuous ones and practicing the virtuous ones. Okay, so here the body is the chief object involved in our actions. So yes, we have mental actions, but in our daily life, yeah, it's our body that moves, it's our mouth that moves. Okay, chief body involved in our actions. Feelings are the aim for which we do these actions. We seek to experience pleasurable feelings and to avoid unpleasant ones. So that thing about feelings is what motivates, you know, it sparks the mental factors that are the motivations for what we do. Okay? Because the seeking to experience pleasures is a mental factor. The seeking to avoid unpleasant things, also a mental factor. The mind is the agent that causes these actions. Our actions just don't happen. The mental factor of intention causes us to act. And then various mental factors, such as attachment and animosity, constitute the motivating force of our actions. Because mental factors, such as various emotions, attitudes, and views, motivate our actions, we must be attentive to what we allow to occupy our awareness. Yeah? So what objects do we contact with our sense organs? What feelings arise from them? how the the craving for pleasure, the craving to be free of pain arises, the intention to get that pleasure, get rid of that pain, okay? And that's the creation of karma, and that's our experience in as sentient beings in the human realm. So basically, what these four mindfulnesses are about is looking at our experience. Yeah, not in the way that fashion designers look at the body, or the way that artists look at the body. Yeah, not in the way that doctors look at feelings, or the way that people look at their emotions, their mental factors. Yeah, so it's a different way of seeing these things. Yeah, that's what we'll be training in. Okay, so there's a reflection. This is your homework. Investigate assumptions in your mind that may be so habitual you don't recognize them. Yeah. Identify in your experience these four conceptual errors. We have so many concepts, yeah, habitual concepts that we just automatically go to that we don't even realize our conceptual minds, and we structure our life around them, okay? Before I go through the reflection here, things like what are some ideas? Oh, it's cold out. I might get sick. Yeah. Or, oh, I'm going to see so-and-so today. Oh, I'm already in a bad mood. I don't want to see them. Or, oh, I get to see so-and-so over here. Oh, yes, I feel happy just thinking about that person. You know? And we just respond so quickly like that, you know, instead of seeing those two people, instead of thinking, I see two sentient beings, you know, afflicted by ignorance, anger, and attachment. We don't think that. We think, oh, I'm seeing a person I don't like. Ugh. Oh, I'm seeing a person I do like. Woo-wee. Yeah. And it's just there, you know. Yeah. Oh, I can see the person I like. Let's see, how can I spend more time with them? Oh, I have to go to the dentist today. You know, oh, he's going to drill on my teeth. Oh, no. What excuse can I keep from going to the dentist? Yeah. I'll put it off. Yeah, right. So you get a worse pain because you eventually you got to go to the dentist. Yeah. And the more you put it off, the more, yeah, it'll be uncomfortable. Better to do it now. Okay? But these concepts just come in our mind right away, and we operate on them. Yeah? Or you could see it, you know, how people, when they are prejudiced against certain kind of people, they just see somebody with a certain color skin, and like that, they have a conceptual mind, you know, and a judgment that affects how they feel and affects their actions. Yeah. And we have so many of these habitual conceptual responses that we are totally out to lunch with. We don't recognize them. Yeah. And so this practice is one of really slowing down and beginning to recognize some of those things. Yeah. Okay. So identify in your experience these four conceptual errors. One, conceiving your body to be the place where a real self resides. I am here inside my body. So in your meditation, really sit with that. You know, like, oh yeah, I feel I am here inside my body. Now, why do I feel that? Is it a correct conception? No. Conceiving your feelings to be what a real self experiences. I feel happy. I feel miserable. I feel indifferent. Yeah. And identify our feelings and then really look at how we respond to the feelings. The third one, conceiving your mind to be a real self. I am what thinks and perceives. I am in control of things. I am the one who makes decisions. Yeah. And four, conceiving phenomena, especially mental factors, as a, what makes a real self afflictive or purified, virtuous or non-virtuous. I am good because I am compassionate. I am bad because I am spiteful. Yeah, so depending upon what the mental factor is, then we judge the self. Okay, now we're moving into the next section called shared and specific characteristics. So we're going to get into, you know, that section, this section. It's all, you know, giving us some things to meditate on already. You know, the big general principles here that are important. To cultivate insight by analyzing the nature of the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, we examine both the characteristics they share, among the four share, and those that are specific to each. Okay, so first we're going to talk about the shared characteristics. So the shared characteristics is that all four objects, body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, what they all have in common. What are those characteristics? They are impermanent, unsatisfactory, or dukkha in nature. They are empty, and they are selfless. Okay. Do you remember where else we encountered those four?
The four seals?
Not quite. When we talk about when
the first truth.
When Dharmakirti and the Pramanavartika talked about the four characteristics of the first truth, this is what he mentioned. Yeah, that things are impermanent, dukkha by nature, or unsatisfactory by nature. They're empty and they're selfless. Okay, and by understanding those four, we come to realize the fourth seal, which is nirvana, is peace. Okay. So each these four seals relate to the first three of the these four characteristics relate to the first three of the four seals, yeah, and bring about the fourth seal, that nirvana is peace, because then we are no longer afflicted by attachment to impermanent things, unpleasant feelings, all of our berserking mental factors, and so on. Okay, so specific characteristics. So in terms of their specific characteristics, each of the four objects of mindfulness is related in particular to one of the four distorted conceptions. Do you remember the four distorted conceptions? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're the how we misunderstand those Okay. So the four distorted conceptions. One, regarding what is unattractive as attractive, regarding what is foul as, you know, gorgeous. You know? The second one, regarding what is dukkha, suffering, you know, in nature, as being pleasant or happy. Yeah, when you eat chocolate cake. Yeah, the chocolate cake is not happiness in nature. It is unsatisfactory in nature. This is relating to the teaching Geshe Topge gave us, not last Monday, but the previous one. The third one, regarding the impermanent as permanent. Yeah, I'm in such a bad mood. My bad mood is always going to be here. Yeah, I am so angry at that person, I am going to hate them forever. My hatred is permanent. Yeah, we think all these things are just permanent, yeah? And then four is regarding the selfless as having a self. Yeah, so in relation to the four objects of mindfulness, yeah, we regard the body as clean and attractive. So that's the first one, yeah. Our distorted perception is regarding what is unattractive or foul as attractive and pure. Okay, so that's related to the body. Feelings, yeah, as pleasant or happy. That's the second one. We think that, you know, we seek out pleasant and happy feelings, not realizing that they are all unsatisfactory in nature, yeah. The mind as permanent. I have this idea. I am not changing. I have this personality. It's cast in concrete, and I will never change. And then phenomena as having a self. Yeah. So there's real emotions, you know, our mental factors, real emotions, real views. Yeah. The first three distorted conceptions chain us to preoccupations with only the happiness of this life. Okay. So seeing things as the unattractive as attractive, the what is dukkha in nature as happy or pleasant, what is impermanent as permanent, yeah. So these chain us to preoccupations with only the happiness of this life and thus hinder our Dharma practice on a fundamental level. Okay. Let's look at those with some examples, okay? So how does regarding your body as clean and attractive relate to preoccupation with the happiness of this life? And how does that hinder your Dharma practice? Yeah?
Well, if I think of my own body that way, I think of others' bodies that way also, and then I want to get attached, and I want to be involved in all of the body things that this society puts into our head.
Yes, the body is beautiful. Yeah, and you see somebody whose eyes are like diamonds and teeth are like pearls. Yeah, it motivates us. Okay. How about feelings as pleasant or happy? How does that chain us to preoccupations of only this life?
I think feelings should be pleasant. I should always be happy, so mm-hmm. I don't want to do things that would make me uncomfortable or have pain.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes Dharma practice involves being uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Uh-huh.
I think also when you have that view, then the enemies are always outside of us. And mm-hmm. I have difficulty because of everybody else.
Mm.
So I'm not looking at my own stuff at all. It's like, if they wouldn't do that, I'd be happy.
Yeah. Well, that's looking at other people as the cause of, yeah. Mm. Yeah, but very much, yeah, we're reactive. Yeah, we're reactive. Okay, how about regarding impermanent things as permanent? How does that chain you to attachment to the happiness of this life?
All the things that I try to do to live long and long and long, and all the things that I get so upset with when they do change with body. If yeah. I'm not using my mind right.
Yeah. I have happiness now. I'm in love. It's going to last forever. Yeah. Oh, I'm depressed. I'm always going to be depressed. You know? Okay. So these hinder our Dharma practice on a very fundamental level. Yeah, so we should go through and really make a lot of examples of these. The main meditations to counteract this obsessive preoccupation with this life are mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of feelings. Okay. For this reason, these are described as foundational practices, although when done by advanced practitioners, they also lead to liberation. So we shouldn't think of, oh, I did the foundation practice. Yeah, I got that under my belt. Let's go on to something more sophisticated for my very near enlightened mind. Yeah. Yeah, I was reading online today. I had to research something. And I came up with a website of one guy who declares that he is a once-returner. Congratulations. It's on the web. Okay. For this reason, meditations to counteract obsessive preoccupation with this life, the mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of feelings, they're described as foundational practices, although when done by advanced practitioners, they also lead to liberation. Yeah. In the stages of the path and the Lamrim teachings, this same purpose of subduing obsession with the happiness of this life is accomplished by reflecting on the four factors that turn the mind to the Dharma. Yeah, precious human life, impermanence and death, the law of karma and its effects, and the disadvantages of cyclic existence. So those are the four that help us really counteract attachment to the happiness of this life. Okay. In addition, yeah, each object of mindfulness is correlated to one of the four truths. Okay, so we have a whole bunch of correlations here. Say, so mindfulness of the body entails contemplating the unattractiveness of the body. In doing so, we are not fabricating foul characteristics and projecting them onto the body, but are simply examining the body and knowing what it is. That's all. Simply examining it and saying, this is what it is. Yeah, this is why in Thailand, you know, the monastics go to autopsies. Yeah, and you see with your eyes what the body is. And then that really helps your meditation. Yeah. How many of you have ever been at a dissection of a human body? Seen that? Yeah. Yeah, I took an anatomy class and saw that, and then also when I went to this autopsy. Yeah, quite interesting. Yeah, you don't look at the body, the inside, and say, oh, that's so beautiful. You know, what Shanti Deva says is, you know, when you say, oh, you want to hug somebody, he says, get a pillow, because a pillow is cleaner than the human body. Yeah. And you don't need to go through so many tricks to hug a pillow. You just need to buy one, you know, or borrow one. Yeah. In chapter 8 in Shanti Deva, he goes through everything you have to do to, you know, attract somebody and you know, court them and get along with them just to have a little bit of pleasure. Yeah.
I have a question about the. I have heard many times from different texts that one particular good karma for rebirth is to be have beauty. I mean, if you have some kind of.
It's a result of good karma.
Yeah, it's a result of good karma. Mm-hmm. So how is related this? And I mean, beauty and good karma. And
When they talk about kind of the exceptional qualities of a precious human life, to be physically attractive, to come from a family in high society, to have wealth and resources, things like that. Okay, that is because those things in our contemporary society make other people pay attention to you. And so if you are a Dharma practitioner, and especially if you're able to attain realizations, it gives you the power to share the Dharma in a way that, you know, because people will pay attention to you. Okay, because when we see people who are young and attractive, we pay more attention than when you see, you know, people that look like me. Yeah. So, you know, this isn't saying it's right. It's not saying it's good. It's just this is the way human beings in our ignorance judge people. Yeah. When we see somebody, you know, if Barack Obama became a Buddhist, you know, people would pay attention. If Donnie became a Buddhist, people would go, wow! Yeah. And they would pay attention because these are people who are famous in society, famous in the world. Okay, if people who are very wealthy, I mean, if Elon Musk, who he's going to become one of the first trillionaires, yeah, because his thing of sending people, you know, going to Mars is going on the stock exchange and people can buy shares in it. And so, and because he's doing AI, so they say everybody except us are going to rush to buy stock from his company. Now, if Elon said, you know, I want to teach you the four establishments of mindfulness, wow, you know. If Tucker Carlson said, you know, I want to teach you about compassion, people would pay attention. Okay, so that's why it is considered a result of your good karma, because it gives you more power to influence people. And if you're a practitioner, you can do that in a good way. Yeah. If you're not a practitioner and you create a lot of negativity, then you influence people in a negative way, yeah, which we see all over the place, don't we? Okay, so just again, mindfulness of the body entails contemplating the unattractiveness, the foulness of the body. In doing so, we are not fabricating foul characteristics and projecting them onto the body, but are simply examining the body and knowing what it is. Through this, we can understand true dukkha. Yeah. This does not mean that the body is inherently foul. Yeah, you know, but in the way we relate to it, the way every species relates to it, you know, they, you know, all the species, after they poop, they get rid of the poop. What produced the poop? The body, you know. So, you know, the turkeys don't go around saying, oh, my poop is so beautiful. Yeah. Actually, I wish we could toilet train the turkeys, yeah, because they really poop in very inconvenient places, like the walkway around the Buddha Hall. That's one of their favorite places to poop. And the paths going, you know, from or just around the Abbey. Oh, yeah. We've all seen that. And it's not like we look at turkey poop and go, oh, this is gorgeous. So we certainly don't look at our own poop that way. Okay. Mindfulness of feelings demonstrates that all feelings of pleasure, pain, and neutral feelings are the nature of dukkha. They are unsatisfactory in nature. Even though we may sometimes feel pleasure, it's unsatisfactory because it doesn't last. And if we keep doing the thing that gives us pleasure, it eventually turns into suffering. So the classic example is when you start to eat, when you're hungry, you experience pleasure. But if food had real pleasure and gave real pleasure, the more you ate, the happier you would feel. But if you keep doing that, you have a stomach ache. Yeah. Try that for sex. People say, sex, wow, the utmost happiness. Now, imagine you have sex, and then immediately you have sex, and immediately you have sex, and immediately, and you are chained to that person because you're having sex with them again and again and again. The expressions on your faces. I wish the people online could see that. Yeah, that is not going to bring happiness, is it? It's like, get me out of here. Yeah. Which really shows that sexual pleasure is not real sex pleasure. Yeah. This is our fabrication. Okay. So even though we may sometimes feel pleasure, it doesn't last and leads to unhappiness when we can't get it. Yeah. Even when we have neutral feelings, the stage is set for pain to arise at any time. Think about this. Our bodies are so sensitive, yeah, that even right now, if something doesn't hurt, we could do the smallest thing and it starts to hurt. Yeah, smallest thing, yeah. Because there's all sorts of pains and discomfort and tightness and, you know, from small to big. Yeah. And that could happen just when we don't expect it at all. Yeah. You just ate a good meal and then you feel nauseous. You stand up and your legs hurt. You know, you sit down and your tush hurts. Yeah, something hurts. Okay. Even, yeah, Okay, even though we may sometimes feel pleasure, it doesn't last, and if we keep doing it, it leads to unhappiness. Even when we have neutral feelings, the stage is set for pain to arise at any time. Understanding the unsatisfactory nature of feelings helps us to understand craving, because we have a feeling, you know, and we crave for a pleasant one to continue. We crave to get rid of the negative one, yeah, the one we don't like. Yeah, and that is what makes the world go round. Yeah. So knowing this leads to us to understand that ignorance is the source of suffering. Yeah, because the unsatisfactory nature of feelings, that worldly feelings are not going to bring us contentment and satisfaction and ultimate happiness. Okay, so it helps us to really understand that the ignorance that sees foul things as beautiful, that sees painful things that are dukkha in nature as blissful, you know, that sees all these things, this is all baloney, ignorance. In this way, we come to understand the true origins of suffering, the second truth. Okay? So mindfulness of body, first truth. Mindfulness of feelings, the second truth. Yeah. Mindfulness of the mind reveals the mind to be changeable and momentary, arising and passing away in each moment. This helps us to recognize that the mind is empty of an independent I. Because an independent I that didn't depend on anything else, especially causes, it's permanent. And, you know, it's momentary and changeable. Yeah. So it's a momentary arising and passing away in each moment. So when you have a meditation and you get a little glimmer of something, you know, how long does it last? It's like, I want it back. It was like this little glimmer that, you know, lasted 2 seconds or maybe a minute or two. And, you know, I want it back, I want it back. It's momentary. It's arising, abiding, and ceasing in every moment. Okay. So this helps us to recognize that the mind is empty of an independent I. Okay. There's no mind that is who we are that is permanent. There is no permanent personality. You know, when we get to know people, we say, oh, I know that person really well. I can predict what they're going to do. We're thinking they have a permanent personality, an inherently existent personality with these characteristics. They cannot change, and that's why I can predict how they're going to react. Yeah, that's pretty inaccurate, isn't it? We do it all the time. Okay. So mindfulness of the mind reveals the mind to be changeable and momentary, arising and passing away in each moment. This helps us to recognize that the mind is empty of an independent I. Yeah. The I is dependent on causes and parts. Understanding the changing nature of the mind stimulates us to aspire for liberation and gives us a better understanding of true cessations, the third truth. Okay. Yeah, when we see the changing nature of our mind, how fickle it is, how unstable it is, how it's filled with wrong conceptions, yeah, then that really perks up our renunciation and our determination to attain liberation and Buddhahood. Then 4, mindfulness of phenomena clarifies the mental factors and behaviors to abandon on the path and those to adopt. Okay. This develops our understanding of true paths, the 4th truth. Okay, so when we get to, we become more familiar with the mental factors that arise in our mind, yeah, then it gives us some power to guide how we think that will determine, you know, more realistic mental factors arising instead of different forms of ignorance, anger, and attachment. Practicing mindfulness here means to first employ wisdom and intelligence to understand the nature of these 4 objects through analytical meditation. So this is how to do it. This is the first step. We have to employ our wisdom and intelligence, use it in analytical meditation to just identify and recognize what these objects, these 4 are. Then we maintain mindfulness on them to become more familiar with their characteristics. Oh, this one is, you know, there's foul, you know, it's foul or it's attractive, it's beautiful, it's virtuous. Okay. Then there's another reflection here. Yeah. First point is contemplate the relationship between mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, and mindfulness of phenomena and the 4 truths, what we just went through. Okay. Why is mindfulness of the body correlated with true dukkha? Hello? What do you say? Why is mindfulness of the body correlated with true dukkha?
Maybe no matter what we do, it is a suffering experience. Birth, aging, sickness, and death.
So. Yeah, the body is ripe for suffering. Yeah, and it's ripe for what in nature is suffering, but appears to be happiness too. Okay. Yeah, and why is mindfulness of the feelings correlated with the 2nd truth, the truth of the cause of dukkha?
Mm-hmm. We see that craving is key in that we crave for the pleasant feelings to continue, neutral feelings to become pleasant feelings, and unpleasant feelings to cease immediately and become pleasant feelings. And that under that craving then is the ignorance of the fact that these things are not actually going to be permanent and satisfactory.
Yeah. Okay. And why is mindfulness of the mind correlated with true cessations?
Because the mind can be changed, there is no inherent fixed mind. So when we can change, there is a way out of the true origin and the true cessation.
Yeah, the mind is what pulls us out of samsara, yeah, of the attachment to all these things. The mind is what realizes them, okay? And so that's why the true cessation. It's the mind that attains true cessation, you know. And then the fourth why of mindfulness of phenomena correlated with true paths. Mm-hmm.
The phenomena is like mindfulness of phenomena is what we want to practice. It's the good, we see the good qualities and we see the detrimental qualities.
Yeah. Yeah. So mindfulness of the mind of, mindfulness of phenomena is talking, you know, when we, which mental factors do we want to eliminate? Which mental factors do we want to practice? You know, and they become the path to awakening. Okay, and then the second question, why is mindfulness of all four objects important? Why are we doing this meditation?
If we don't do all of them, we will still linger in samsara.
Yes. Yeah. So these are really important things to understand. You know, we shouldn't just skip over them and say, you know, oh, I'm doing tantric mindfulness. My body is made of pure light. Yeah. My feelings are bliss. Yeah. No, we have to look at what's really going on. And then you begin to see how in Tantra, when you really understand what's really going on as a sentient being, then you can understand how Tantra works to flip those, you know, in how we look at them. Okay, so the meditations on the four establishments of mindfulness are explained below. Because there are many meditations for each of the four objects, summarizing the instructions as reflections for you to do would make the book too long. Yeah? So I didn't go through and with each one list out, you know, all the different ways that you're supposed to contemplate this one. For the body especially, oh my goodness, we'd go on and on. But there's some other books, especially on this topic, that do. So please pause after each section, write out the steps of each meditation, and then guide yourself in doing the meditation. Okay? So instead of, I'm not going to, you know, the authors did not baby you, spoon feed you. Yeah, you have to write out the points yourself and then meditate on them. Each time you do a meditation, you will discover more about the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Okay, and then above that, that paragraph is the chart, the objects of mindfulness. Yeah, those four objects, the four distorted conceptions and the misconceptions that go with each one and the truths, which of the four truths. Okay, so the body, the misconception, is holding the foul as clean. The understanding of the specific characteristic, you know, here foulness, is it is foul in nature. Yeah, the Arya truth is the truth of dukkha. For feelings, the misconception is holding what is unsatisfactory in the nature of dukkha as pleasurable. Okay, the understanding of that is understanding that feelings are unsatisfactory in nature. When we can understand that, so much of the craving just goes down. Yeah. And then the Arya truth that it's especially goes after is the truth of the origin of dukkha. Okay, the mind, the misconception, is holding what is momentary as permanent. Yeah, I have a permanent mind, a permanent personality. My mind is never going to change. Even from one lifetime to the next, I have the same exact mind. I'm going to have the same opinions in all my lifetimes, you know. So, you're holding what is momentary as permanent. And the understanding of it is the mind arises and passes away in each moment. And that's associated with truth of cessation. And then phenomena, the misconception, holding what lacks a self as having a self, and the understanding of that specific characteristic is that phenomena are not the self. Some phenomena are to be practiced and others abandoned. And so that is the truth of cessation, truth of the path. Okay, now, just the fact that each of these four is associated with one of the misconceptions does not mean that it is free of the other misconceptions. So the main thing with the body is we hold the, what is foul is beautiful, but we also think our body is permanent. Yeah. And so you're surprised when, we're surprised when we age. We also think, that our body is inherently existent, that it has a self. We think that the body is the source of pleasure. So each of these different characteristics apply to each one, even though each of the four is associated specifically with one of them. Okay. So, questions, comments, yeah.
So, back at the very beginning, when we were going through, some of the inner and outer things, mm-hmm. I'm hoping for some clarification. So, for instance, for the tactile consciousness, it was said that it's in the inner and outer, but only that one? Because I would imagine, I think what you said was that the inner part is the consciousness, but then it's coming into contact with an external, mm-hmm. An external phenomena, but the same is true for, say, a sight, right? My visual mm-hmm. consciousness. So is that then also inner and outer, or is it only tactile?
No. Here, when you will look for each of the four, mm-hmm. they describe something inner, something outer, and something that is both. Mm-hmm. So that was the one for tactile.
So is that an example, or the only one that is?
Oh, that's an example.
Okay, that solves it. And then a second question.
I think so. I mean, that's what makes sense to me. Yeah.
I hope so. I like it when things make sense.
Makes sense means they agree with our ignorance.
Exactly. there was the statement, so inner and outer again, the mind apprehending the sense organs for the mind. Does apprehending the sense organs...
You can see somebody else's eyeball.
Okay, or like, smelling someone's skin.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
More confusion, I'm sorry. For the phenomena in particular, it said inner phenomena are true paths, outer phenomena are true cessations.
It says that?
Yes. But then it also was talking overall about mental factors, and I'm not used to thinking about individual mental factors being true paths or true cessations. So I struggled to parse that.
True cessations are permanent, Yeah. Right. But where does it say that that's what
Sorry,
they
so
are?
Sorry, so back on page 331 near the bottom.
Yeah.
Phenomena includes all other phenomena.
Yeah, both impermanent and permanent.
That so not, the last yeah. sentence of that paragraph. Inner mm-hmm. phenomena and that
are true paths. Outer phenomena are true cessation. Inner and outer are the person. So here I think it's poetic, so to speak. You know, inner phenomena, what we want to cultivate, true paths. What do we attain from it? Out is called outer phenomena, the true cessations.
Okay.
Yeah. And inner and outer are the persons who do that.
Okay, thank you.
That's the best I can make sense of it. Okay? But we can contemplate this some more and see. Yeah.
I want to clarify, maybe if you could say something about the awakening factors. I understand those are different from the mental factors and in the relationship with the Four Noble Truths. I mean, in the explanation with the mindfulness of them.
Yeah, when we get to, when we talk about the 37 harmonies with awakening, that's what you're talking about. Yeah, when we look, those are predominantly mental factors. Yeah. Predominantly, not all. Okay.
Because I remember in the sutta, the Buddha is talking about the awakening, the seven awakening factors.
Oh, those seven. Okay. Okay. Let's get the list of them. Okay. I thought you were talking about the 37. Okay. Where are we? Okay. So mindfulness of the seven awakening factors. Okay. So these are... Okay. So these seven awakening factors are mindfulness, discrimination of phenomena, effort, joy, pliancy, concentration, and equanimity. So those are all mental factors.
Yeah, and why? I mean, my question is exactly why?
Why are they seven awakening factors? Because those are what we have to activate in our mind to attain awakening. You know, all these 37 are just harmonies with awakening are describing the path to awakening and what things we have to grow in our own mind. Yeah, so for example, with the seven awakening factors, we need to identify these in our mind and then we need to refine them and use them, you know, to create merit, to purify our mind, to realize emptiness. Yeah? Okay. Good. Yeah, when we get to looking at all 37, it's quite interesting. We can do more of that when we look at all 37. Other questions? Anybody online? No? Okay, then we'll dedicate. Okay, so we're stopping on 336. And there we'll start going into mindfulness of the body in more depth.